Mr. Friedman, thank you for accommodating our request to conduct this interview with you. As you may already know, she and I are PhD students studying game design with Dr. Carly Kosarik from the Lewis College of Humanities at Illinois Institute of Technology. This interview is part of our History of Video Game oral documentary project, where we are charged with interviewing an individual connected with the Chicago coin-operated video game industry. You have kindly agreed to allow us to enter into your world of gaming and competitions, as well as to see and experience firsthand some of your personal gaming collection. We will be recording the interview with an audio recorder, and we'll also need to take at least one photograph of you, preferably outside, to capture that natural light. Before we begin, we need to request that you sign two copies of the consent form. One signed copy is yours, one signed copy is ours, and it will be submitted to Illinois Institute of Technology to allow this interview to be posted to the Chicago Coin Op Archive, located at chicagocoinop.org. This archive collects interviews related to the history and culture of coin-op gaming in the greater Chicago area. Now, if you do not have any questions regarding the consent form, digital documentation, posting in the interview online at the chicagocoinop.org website, or context of why we are conducting the interview, we can begin the interview. My name is Jody Goulihan. I'm a PhD student in Technology and Humanities at the Illinois Institute of Technology. My PhD advisor is Dr. Carly Kosarik, and I am studying the area of influencing behavior change through game design strategies. This is my colleague.
Hi, I'm Shi. I'm in the PhD program in Technology and Humanities at Illinois Institute of Technology. So I've been taking a game class with Dr. Carly Kosarik.
And your advisor is?
And my advisor is Libby Hempel.
Cool. Okay. So we can begin?
You can begin.
All right. So the first question I'm going to open up with is, what does the typical day look like for Todd Friedman?
Depends on the day, actually, but usually, typically during the week, I'm an EDI analyst at Hub Group Transportation in Oak Brook. What is EDI? It's basically electronic data interchange. It's a programmable language to make purchase orders and invoices and information for the company electronically. So that's my job. I've been there almost 3 years. Before that, I was at Medline Industries in Mundelein for about 6 years doing EDI. Typically my days from about 6 a.m. I wake up. I drive to work in Oak Brook, so it takes me about 45, 50 minutes to get there. And work till about 3:30 and get home about a little before 4:30. I'm a father of three. I have an older son. He's 23, so he's on his own. But I do have 9-year-old twins that I'm a father with. And they keep me busy when I get home, so I do the fatherly stuff. I coach soccer, baseball. My daughter's in Palms this year, cheerleading, so I'm excited to be watching her cheerlead for the Warren High School and here in Gurnee. So, yeah, that's pretty much my day. On weekends, it's more of the same of with the children. I do a lot of like outside activities. Like, we have passes to Six Flags. We go there quite a bit. If Six Flags isn't open, like in the winter, we do a lot of outdoor activities and stuff like that. So, yeah, work and being a father is my typical day.
That's your typical day.
Yeah.
How long have you been playing video games?
I've been playing video games probably since 1979. I was born in 1974, so I was about 5 years old when I first started playing video games. I saw most of my friends had, I think it was an Atari 2600 at the time, and I was amazed by the technology and how you can play organized, like, technical gaming on the TV, and I was just mesmerized by it and addicted to it. I grew up in a family that we had a lot of technology with my parents. They always buy us the latest and greatest things, and my dad would always have the latest techie stuff, so I was just always grew up with technology and cool ideas. So probably 1979. My first video game systems that I actually owned were probably in the early 80s. Probably 1983 is when I got my first system. So
you lead me to the next question, which is really good.
Yeah.
Why do you like to or not like to play some of your first games? And what was that first game that you had that stands out in your memory?
Oh, I've had many games before this game that I'm going to mention, but the one that I've always stuck out with me that I'll never, and I still play today, that I never forget is The Legend of Zelda. It's the original. It's the one that we talked about when you got here. But it basically was the first kind of role-playing game, if you want to call it that, back in the early 80s, where you're kind of, there's an adventure, there's a storyline, there's a princess that you have to save at the end, and there's dungeons, and that game just got me addicted. It was also like one of the first Nintendo games back in the day where you could save your game and not have to start over when you turn it off. So I was pretty addicted to that, where you can just play for a couple hours, save it, come back later. So that game will always be my number one game and favorite game to this day. I still play it, and they make it on different models now where you can play it on... By the way, that's my clock. That goes off every hour. So on the tape, that's my clock. So yeah, The Legend of Zelda is my all-time favorite.
But what was, like, the first... You told me why you liked it.
Yeah.
What I would like you to mention for the audio
sure.
recorder is what your wife did with the original Zelda.
Yeah,
so
the original Zelda came out, and when it came out with two versions. There was a gray boxed version, a gray cartridge version, and then there was a gold version. And I stood in line, I think, for 2.5 hours back in the day to get the gold version. And it was a little more expensive, not much more expensive, but I got the gold version. And it's the same game, it's just, at the time, it was kind of, you got the gold version, you're kind of the cool person on the block. And I had that game ever since today. I still have the exact cartridge. About 2 years ago, for my birthday, my wife saw online a cool idea to make a working desk clock out of your old video games. And she knew that The Legend of Zelda was my all-time favorite game, so she wanted to surprise me and actually take the original cartridge and design it herself. And she made a working clock, which we discussed. And I was very surprised when I first opened it, very excited to see a working Zelda clock, like, this is the best gift ever. And I said, where did you get the cartridge? And she said it was in the garage. And I go, like, oh, Aaron, I said, that's cool. I was trying to be so nice. And I think it's still sentimental. I'll always have the clock. And I took out the inside as the microchip so I could play that game in another cartridge. But it was just a funny story that that's my all-time favorite game, the original game that I got. I stood 2.5 hours in line, and then she drilled a hole in the back and put the clock in there. So, yeah, it's a good story. I'm really excited she did it, because I don't think any other game would have meant the same to me if she did it to another game. So,
so the first games that you played, you
yeah.
mentioned a little bit about Zelda.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit more about what these games looked like, how they felt in regards to the types of consoles, interface, features, or stories that they had? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, the first games that, you know, came out historically are, you know, everyone talks about Pong, which is basically just the two lines back and forth, kind of like a ping pong game. So that was the most unique thing that came out back in the day. And the progress of the graphics and the technology just amazed me. I can remember, like, playing Super Mario Brothers and, you know, being able to, like, go from side to side, scroll from side to side and get, like, mushrooms and get, you know, the bad guys. And then after that, then they came out, you know, years later with the 3D graphics. And so my love for it is every year there's just new technology that makes it more fun and more challenging. Like when the Wii came out, it was the cordless, you know, you could play a game just with a wand, and that was just the coolest thing for me and my children. They could play any game they wanted now without having to have like 17 buttons. And now they even have the wireless Kinects where you don't even need a joystick. You just use your body on the screen and you can play games. So that's what my fascination is just the amount of change that's grown since, geez, I mean, it's only been probably at its prime, it's only been 30 years, really, since gaming got big, and it's a $1 billion industry, so.
You play these games, and I'm going to go back to the feel of them, and you have these consoles, and some of the consoles you have to play almost on top of the TV, and
yeah.
then you mentioned with Wii, you could be away from it.
Right.
What was your experience like playing almost on top of the game versus that freedom of not having to be on top of the game?
You know, I didn't think anything of it at the time. Everyone, I mean, back then it was just, everyone had one or two TVs, so you were used to kind of sitting on top of a TV or watching TV. And, you know, with the old games, it was almost like you had to, like, be on the TV to feel like you're in the game. So if you were far away from the game back then, you felt like, you know, you weren't part of it. And, yeah, just the closer you were to the TV, the more you're into the game. So it didn't bother me. I mean, it was part of the experience. I think as time went on, the remote's cords got longer and longer. It wanted people to stay away from the TV. But, you know, still today, I sit really close to a TV, because I feel like it's part of the experience, you know. And then you have the surround sound headphones now, and to be in the game is more of the experience. So,
my next question, which I believe you answered, but there might be a few others that you might want to discuss.
Okay.
Your ultimate favorite classic game is the Zelda.
Yeah.
What are the other ones that are kind of runners up?
My all-time favorite arcade game, when I grew up, you know, also there was arcades were huge. Everywhere you went, there was an arcade, bowling alleys, gas stations. But the one that I always recall and love to this day is Moon Patrol. And that was basically an arcade game in the 80s where you were a car that would have to jump over crevices in the road. You'd have to shoot the people in front of you, and you'd have a gun on top of your car where you'd shoot people above you. And it's kind of this alien kind of background where you're on like a planet. And you have to shoot like alien ships and then rocks in your way. And there was two joysticks. It was a unique setup because most games just had a joystick and a button. This had two joysticks where you'd use one to drive back and forth and one to shoot up or down. So that one was just so unique for me. And if I find that game ever, I play it all the time still. So other games that stand out obviously are Super Mario. I mean, that's the most popular one. And I have it in my garage there. We were looking at it. I could still play that game like it was yesterday. It's really fun. Another one is Mike Tyson's Punch Out for the Nintendo. I hold a few world records on that game. For some reason, I just the patterns and knowing that there's different ways to punch the boxers and get past to the next person is just always fascinating to me. I've been really good at it. So that game's on my top five list. And then there's the Final Fantasy series. Those have been out since probably the late 80s, the first Final Fantasy, I think, came out. And I've played pretty much all of them, but the one out of the whole series was Final Fantasy VII that got me hooked as a role-playing Final Fantasy collector. That one just broke the barriers for graphics, for storyline, for music. I have the soundtrack. The music's unbelievable. That's another thing in video gaming that has taken over is the music of video games and arcades, is you can actually have symphonies that play these games. And I actually went to live concerts that play video game music, and I've met people who are in bands who play video game music. So it's just an all around.
Is that a huge industry?
Yeah, it's huge. There's actually, and I can show you later, there's and I have his autograph, but there's a guy called Tommy Natola. I don't want to mess up his name, I apologize. Tommy Vitola, but he's got a concert that he travels around the world called Video Games Live, where they actually have a 100 to 200 man's or women's symphony orchestra that play the soundtracks of games from Sonic, from Super Mario, to Final Fantasy, to World of Warcraft, all those games on the computer. And it's huge, and it's awesome to just sit and instead of listening to opera or just kind of standard classical music, you're listening to the video games.
When you listen to the video games like that,
yeah.
You had mentioned you've gone to them.
Yeah.
Do you picture yourself playing at certain times?
What do you
picture when you're
listening? I picture me playing it, but what's amazing about the concerts is they have widescreen and huge setups that actually show the games in the background while they're playing the music. So as you're listening to music, you're watching your memories are just flashing in front of you with the screen at the top. But yeah, it just brings back my childhood of all those old games. So yeah, music is definitely another number one attraction for me with the gaming.
Have you ever been a full-time game competitor?
Not full-time. I've never made money off of it. I have been in competitions, and I have world records on console video gaming, where I'd have to videotape my scores and submit them to a company, a website, and they'd have to verify my score, and I hold world records. I've never been the big competitive gaming right now is the fighting games, like Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, stuff like that, as well as the online Call of Duty shooter games, and I've never been a big player of those. So I haven't entered those kind of competitions professionally. I know people who have. I know very good friends who have made a lot of money doing it and still today do it. But my big love is going to different like conventions and stuff around the area. I've traveled as far as Iowa from here, you know, 6 hours just to competitively play against people. And I do it for the fun. I don't really need to do it for the money. It's just more of a hobby for me.
Is it also like a community? Do you get to know certain people in it?
Yeah, and that's the best part of probably my last, I would say, 10 to 11 years is the community of people I've met. We talked about the movie I watched called The King of Kong that got me into this community. Twin Galaxies is one of the major players of world record holders, arcade players, and console players. And there's a website and a community that you can go onto and meet all these people. And I took it to the next level, and I met Walter Day, the founder, and I've met Billy Mitchell, who's in The King of Kong. I've met Steve Wiebe. I've met a lot of these players who started this group back in 82. And from there, I just branched out and met so many different people. I've met arcade owners, I've met arcade designers, I've met pinball designers, I've met people throughout the last 30, 35 years that have been an influence in this industry. And I'm pretty proud of you know, people that I can call my friend and people who I could, if I need any advice or if I need to go somewhere or get some items for my collection, that I could call them. And I think it's a good thing. I think nowadays there's a lot of negativity in the world and a lot of things that I could be doing that aren't positive. And without this, I think, you know, I'd miss it. I'm glad I got involved.
When you talk about Twin Galaxies, yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about Twin Galaxies?
Twin Galaxies was founded back in 1982 by Walter Day. It was basically, that's when the arcade boom, I should say, started, where everywhere you went, people were playing games competitively, trying to beat the high score of the screen. And
these were arcade games.
These are arcade games. These are arcade games. Consoles weren't as popular yet. I don't think consoles really hit households till about 85. And in 1982, the arcades were taking, you know, were mostly in the world. And people were setting these high scores, and they were wondering if it's the best in the world, or in the United States, and even, you know, South America, Canada. And there wasn't an organization that kept track of all these scores. So Walter Day decided to come up with his own company, called it Twin Galaxies, where you could submit your scores to him. And that would be the official high score. If you wanted to set a high score in an arcade, you would submit it to Twin Galaxies.
How did you submit it? How did you document it to get it to him?
There's many ways to do it. Now it's more technical, where you can actually do it digitally. You can upload it on like YouTube or something. But what I did for my DJ Hero records was I just took a tripod, as you see here, and put my video camera and filmed this TV. And there's lots of rules involved. You have to make sure you videotape it from start to finish. You have to turn on the console. They watch every video that you've done from start to finish to make sure there's no cheating, any editing of the data. So I submitted probably, my first submission was probably 5 or 6 different scores. And at the time, DJ Hero just came out. So there was no one to really set the bar, so I decided I would do it. So I sent in all my scores. I think I first sent in, the first DJ Hero game had about 100 and something songs, and I did every song. I just wanted to set the bar for everybody, and to this day, there's still, I think I still have about 90 something scores that haven't been beat. So there are some scores I haven't beat that I tried to beat, and some I did and some I couldn't. But yeah, then DJ Hero 2 came out, and I did the same thing. I set the bar, and there's about 60 or 70 songs, and I still hold about 40 of those records. So that's how I got involved. I went to TwinGalaxies.com when I heard about them back in 2007, and I found out that Walter Day and the Twin Galaxy community is coming to Lombard. So I immediately went on the website of this community, and I said, I'd love to help out. I want to be a part of this. I want to meet Walter. I want to, you know, get involved. And the person running the convention at the time said, we need some help. Would you like to help? And I did. And to this day, I'm going on my 8th year. I run a video game summit, is what we call it. But it's a convention in Lombard where we host vendors, competitors, world record holders, industry leaders, and we all get together once a year and do gaming and compete, trade games, sell games, talk about games, and I'd love to do that more. My goal is to get at least 2 or 3 a year instead of once a year.
That was why I asked what your typical day was. I was wondering where you fit in your gaming.
Yeah. Yeah, my gaming, I'd love to game more. It is just very difficult being, you know, in my life, being a father, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. It's just there's so much gaming out there, it's hard to keep up. So I just do as much I can. My 9-year-old son is now involved, so we kind of set a limit for him, and we say, this is how many hours you could play a week, and I sit down and play with him. I teach him. He's actually better at me in most games now. But I think the coolest thing is taking my old games from the 80s and playing with them, because I was his age when I started like that, and now he's playing my games from them, and to recycle history like that is very fascinating to me.
I would think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, yeah, I would think that when I hear music, it brings me back to a certain time in my life. If it was music I heard when I was in high school or grammar school, and I would think the same would come with the games.
Oh, yeah. 'Cause
it seems to put a time frame, you know, with the initial time that you played that game when you were really good, when you played that game. When you play the games with your son, the older games, do you start telling him, reminiscing about your life back then?
I do. I do. In fact, there's a recent story where I would show him a game I played, and a few of my friends that I played those games with, I'm still friends with today. And when I see those friends with my younger son, I say, hey, you know, John, I just played Mike Tyson Punch-Out with Aiden, and he can beat, you know, this person. And he's like, oh, yeah, remember when we were playing in your bedroom back then, and we had the same problem? And then, like, my son would talk to my friend about the games we played when we were kids. So it's really cool. And that just happened recently. And so I really enjoy it. And I'd love to do it more if I had the time. And, you know, as he gets older and, you know, he goes on to different things, I'm hoping maybe he could get more involved with the community with like I'm doing. He just recently, for the first time, he helped me do the last one in July. We did our video game summit in July, and he came and he stayed the whole time. We got there at 7 in the morning. We left at 8 at night. He helped me set up. He sold tickets. He helped people set up the games, and he loved it. I thought he'd be out in like 2-3 hours, just be tired and want to leave, and he made it the whole day, and he wanted to do it again. So,
do you think he'll be submitting any world record
scores? Yeah, you know, funny you should say that. We went to an arcade, which you might have heard of in your class, but Galloping Ghosts is an arcade in Brookfield, Illinois, and I took him there recently for another convention, a video game trading card convention, and he sat down at this arcade. It's a motorcycle. Oh, no, it wasn't a helicopter. It was like an airplane game where you had to sit down and it moved while you moved, and he played for like 2-3 hours, and he broke the high score that day. He didn't break the world record, but he broke the high score for that day. And he was so happy. So I told the guy at the counter, and they made him a signed world record holder for today. And he goes, Dad, I want to submit scores. I want to be a world record holder, and I want a video game card like you have. And I'm like, you will, keep it up. So, yeah, to answer your question, he's adamantly wants to follow my footsteps in that. He wants to be a world record holder. He wants to set scores. And I think it's cool. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. There could be much worse things in the world he could be doing. So,
we spoke about your wife. We spoke about your son.
Yeah.
What about your daughter in gaming?
My daughter in gaming is fun. And to me, it's cute to see my daughter play games. I think we spoke briefly before the interview about the kind of gaming she loves. She loves the Nintendo Wii games. Like, she loves to play the dance games where you can just hold the Wii remote and dance in front of the TV and keep track of your scores. She loves the Mario games. Any Mario game we have, she'll play. She loves Princess Peach. So nowadays, the Mario games you can play as Princess Peach. So she always plays Princess Peach, and we play as Mario and Luigi. And with the Wii, you can play four players at once. So the three of us can play, or even my wife joins in. We have four people at one time. So I know there's a lot of times we play more games than she does, and she watches and stuff, but there's times where she'll be like, I want to play that game. I want to play with you guys. And I welcome it. I don't say, oh, it's daddy's son time, or I don't say any of that. I just have her play.
As far as you're concerned, it's a family event. Anybody in the family that wants to play.
I try to get my wife more involved. She's more of a kind of the old school PlayStation games. It's kind of the newer games with the graphics and stuff she's not really into. So the handheld games, she plays a lot of those iPhone games. She's more of like an app game. She loves like playing like Candy Crush, and those things are the hot things nowadays. So she will do that. But as far as console games, she always says, you know, she doesn't get the hobby, she doesn't get the collection, but she supports it, and she thinks it's cool that you know her husband is at a video game convention. So
we talked about memorable experiences. Do you have any other memorable experiences in the competitive arena? And why were they so special to you?
I did an event in Iowa. It was called the Gauntlet. This is what I'm proud of. I did not win. I think I came in third. But what was cool about it is they set up a almost like a marathon gaming tournament where you'd start with a game and you'd get to a certain score, and then when you're done, you'd move to the next screen and play a different game on a different system. And they had about seven or eight systems. You went from Atari to Nintendo to Sega to the Wii, and it was like a transformation of the history of gaming, and it was a tournament. And I did really well, and I was proud of myself because I always consider myself a retro console, kind of a more of a retro console tournament player than a newer, like I said, Call of Duty or the newer PS4 games. So when I entered, I was really excited. I wanted to win. I didn't. But I got third, and there was about probably 40 to 50 entries. So that was one of my good memories that happened, I think, about 3 years ago. Other things, you know, like I said, I do mostly for fun. I don't have a lot of, like, competitive, like I was in a tournament and you know, I won money. But that one was one of my big memories, because you're just not playing one game for 2-3 hours. You had to play each game at different, you know, consoles throughout the generation. And so you had to be good at all the different joysticks and all the different kind of hand-eye coordinations. So I was pretty proud of that.
You mentioned that you hold some world records. Could you tell me which ones they were? Which ones they are?
Yeah, I should have done the research, because I should have expected this question. But I think there's about 86 DJ Hero records. Probably 50 or 60 DJ Hero 2 records. And I don't hold the world records, but I'm in the top five of three of the Mike Tyson Punch-Out records. I think I'm third in a few of them, and fourth and fifth in the other ones. And then I hold the Nintendo Wii Golf world record for lowest score, or best score for 9 holes, which is a 31 or a 30. So those are the ones that are documented. There's many ones that I have beat, but I didn't submit, or I, you know, kind of competitively played against someone who was a world record holder and won, but it's not official. So those are the ones that are documented on Twin Galaxies' website under my name.
I know that you play for the fun of it, not so much the competition of it, but I'm just trying to garner your experience as a competitor, and then I wanted to talk to you more about the competitions that you've run. So when you do compete, Is it individually, or do you like to compete on a team? Which one do you prefer?
I'm more of an individual competitor. A lot of the team events are, like I said, are the first-person shooter games,
okay.
Or the like online, they're called MMOs, kind of the World of Warcraft kind of tournament ones, and so I'm more of an individual.
Okay.
Yeah, so I prefer the individual ones over them.
This question I'm very interested in. When you play a game, such as one of the ones that you hold a world record for,
mm-hmm.
when do you know the game well enough to feel confident to compete in a competition? When do you feel that you're at that level that you can compete in a competition?
Well, with DJ Hero is kind of a no-brainer because I've always been into music and DJing. If I wasn't doing computer work or IT work, I always said I'd be a DJ growing up. I have done kid benefits, like DJed music there. I've done a few weddings, like I played music at weddings and DJed. I've always been fascinated by professional DJs on TV. So I always knew that when DJ Hero came out, that it was a no-brainer that I would play that game till I had all the world records and enjoyed it tremendously. I just felt like I can't play Guitar Hero. I was bad at Rock Band. I'm bad at the drums. And then when I saw DJ Hero, it was a no-brainer. I knew that that game would be my ticket to like world records. The Mike Tyson Punch-Out one, like I said, is in my top five favorite game of all time, so I wanted to at least kind of submit some world records there, because I always thought, you know, you couldn't do it back when I did it, so I might as well try now. And, you know, there's games where you just naturally are good at it based on your hand-eye coordination. I'm not a big sports player like the Maddens or the NHL games. I'm just really bad with the buttons But when it comes to like more of like kind of the side-scrolling games or the shooting games, like side-scrolling shooting games, not first-person, I just have a natural ability to score high with my eye-hand coordination. That's why I like the retro games a lot better than the newer games, because of the almost like the simplicity of the joysticks. There's only two or three buttons. Nowadays, the Xboxes or the PS4s have like 20 buttons, and, you know, I'm all for the kids nowadays being good at those. I'm just more of a simplicity. Sit in front of the screen, know the patterns, get the scores. And so,
is there? Because I had read this before regarding people who are into esports.
Mm.
Is there training that takes place for that? Do people train?
Oh yeah, I know many people, and when we're done, I can give you. I have documentaries over there of professional competitors who train. There's groups out there who twice, three, four times a week go to someone's apartment and play for 8-9 hours and just practice and train and get their skills down and their buttons and the, you know, the more you play, the better you are, is what they say. But I know a lot of people in that industry who that's their life. Some people even work throughout the day, and then when they get home, from like 5 o'clock till midnight, they're training, they're practicing, they're gaming, and it's a huge business. You can make a lot of money if you're a professional gamer, and very successful at it. There's a few names, you know, I throw out there. One is Justin Wong. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's been in the competitive gaming business probably the last 10 years, where he's got sponsors, he's got t-shirts from him, you know, he's got a documentary about himself. He's made $10,000-$30,000 just playing Street Fighter games, and maybe even more. I'll be honest, he probably has made more, but it's a big business, and if you're good at it, you need training. And he probably is one of the biggest, probably the most successful ones recently in these days.
So you're a record holder of several games.
Mm-hmm.
What are the perks that come along with being a world record holder or winning a competition?
Oh, I mean, it's like any sport, really, and it's like anything that you're successful at. It's just having a good, I don't want to say story, but it's a good memory. It's things where you can share with your children and your parents and grandchildren, and you can, you know, I have awards that, you know, with my picture on it, and I'm proud of those. It's like, you know, I'm a big bowler. I've been bowling since I was 8 years old. I've had perfect games. I've had championships. I have, you know, won a lot of money and scholarships in bowling. But, you know, I compare it to the video gaming. I have awards from video gaming. I have world records. And it's just the satisfaction of getting accepted in something like that. It's really thrilling to have people talk about you and look up to you when it comes to doing stuff like games, or, you know, being part of a community where you can say it's a positive thing. You know, I'm not a, you know, never got into trouble with drugs or alcohol or, you know, stuff like that. And I can honestly say that I'm proud to be part of that. You know, I don't want to go down the negative path. I like to stay positive, and this is what I do to stay positive.
Well, when you talk about, like, drugs and alcohol, yeah, and things like that, those are negative things. But gaming, I see being fun and laughing and memorable.
Oh, yeah, and it can be.
The things that you've said already.
And it can be, but like I said, if you're competitive like that, and I'm not at that level, but there are people that are competitive, they eat, drink, sleep, video gaming, and it's their life, and they take it seriously. There's stress involved, there's lack of sleep, I mean, there's pressure. And like I said, like any sport, baseball, football, soccer, anything, you know, if you're going to be competitive, you have to, you know, there's going to be ups and downs. It can be fun, and it is fun, but if you want to be successful, you have to, you know, deal with the pressure.
It's when you found a game that you really liked, mm-hmm, did you ever experience a lack of sleep or stress from it?
You know, I'm the opposite. And I say this to my wife, is if I am stressed, I play games to calm me down. It's more like a stress reliever. Instead of people who go out and smoke a cigarette or drink alcohol, I play a game to calm me down. So for me, it relieves my stress. It doesn't increase it. And I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, like I said, there's a lot worse things that I could do when I'm stressed out. And I don't have any problem with having a busy day at work or a stressful time with family or friends, just sitting down and escaping with my game.
Was there any time that you worked in the game industry full-time? And if so, what did you do?
Not full-time. I mean, it wasn't my job. I've never been paid to do anything video game related. I would love to. My dream job after high school, I took programming classes, was to design video game characters, like animated on a computer. And it just didn't go that way. My life went in a different direction. So I am here today with what I do with my IT career. But if I could, that would be my dream job, is to work at like Electronic Arts or some sort of studio where I would design games. So that would be my passion.
And what kind of games would you develop? Design.
I'm on board with Nintendo. I'm more of a kid friendly game. I'm more of a guy who you could play with your family. Like, you can sit down and play a game, and it's not hard or easy for any age. You can just sit down and enjoy it and have a great experience as a family. So that would be my kind of gaming. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with shooting games or fighting games or sports games, but I think the family games really are where the money's at, and I think it's where the most popular creativity comes from in the world today. I think Nintendo has it right with the Wii U pad. I think playing four players at once with a family, having different, like, games you could play on there, activities. I think it's right on. It's right where I would want to be if I was in the industry.
Like a Miyamoto?
Yes. That's one guy I'd love to meet. I'm close. I know I can meet him one day if I really tried, but he's a genius. He's he's come up with some classic games, and he's made a lot of money over it.
How do you allocate time for your love for gaming and your full-time corporate career?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I guess it probably depends on when.
Yeah, it depends. Like, I try to balance it. I feel like in my life I need to balance that, because if I don't, I'll go, you know, like I said, the stress level will be really high. So I kind of do my job. I go to work. I focus on work. But when I come home, I kind of just decompress, play games, play with my kids, play games with my kids. So I kind of separate the two.
Well, you also mentioned that you had a birthday party as well.
I did.
And how did that go?
Excuse my cough. Yeah, my 40th birthday was last October. And I knew that it had to be video game related. I knew that that's what was in my life besides, you know, my family. So it was a no-brainer that I would rent out the clubhouse, decorate all the walls with my posters, with my figures, and set up all my TVs. We had about 20 systems set up, from Atari up to the PlayStation. And my wife made me a cake. It was a outline of Super Mario with cupcakes. So the cupcakes were black, red, white, but it was Super Mario. It's a cool picture. So that was really neat. And then I my trading cards that I have that I'll show you later was like, we gave out like chocolate Wii remotes. And on the Wii remotes were my little video game cards attached to them. Those were like party favors when people left. So it was classic. I had all my friends from the 80s that I used to play the games with. They were there with, now with their wives and children. And we played some games. Just had a great time. It was a great memory. And it was exactly what was in my life at the time, and it was a perfect birthday. I always remember it.
So getting back to competitions, now this is where you organize competitions.
Yeah.
I also think you organize, I think I heard you say that you organize conventions.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Well, like I said before, I saw this on the internet. I saw a convention that was in 2007 in Lombard, and I wanted to get involved. And I dove in right away. They wanted me to help organize it, market it, bring people in. And so I got involved and started off small. I think we had about 40 or 50 people that came. And now we're up to, I think we had almost 300 people that came last July. So basically it's open to everybody. We got arcade vendors, pinball, console players, computer, PC players, and we sent out the invitation. We charged, you know, a small fee for vendors to bring their stuff, to display their stuff, to sell, and then we have competitors who come and we run tournaments. We have trophies. We have we don't really typically do competitive gaming for money, but we give out awards. We give out T-shirts. We give out cool, what you call, like, kind of like trinkets or kind of like
swag
items.
Question I was going to ask you.
We are the king of swag for our video game summit. We have so much stuff that we give out, and it's cool stuff, very cool stuff that we do raffles. And when people buy an entry to our convention, we enter them in a raffle, and they get great prizes just for showing up. So we just try to make everyone happy and have a great experience when they leave.
What are some of the swag items?
Oh, we've gone for, like I said, we have T-shirts, figurines, keychains, lanyards. We give out games. Like we gave out a signed Atari 2600 game from someone who designed it. And we've had world record holders show up, and people have signed different items from that game, whether it's a manual or it's kind of like a system that they signed. It varies. It's we've had some cool items from people, and a lot of the vendors donate items for those raffles too. So they've given us some cool things.
What is the life cycle of a competition?
Like
some competitions have regional competitions that lead up to a final competition. Is this every year? I mean, what is the life cycle like?
There's competitions. If you look hard enough, there's competitions every month, and they're all over the place. You know, I typically look in the Midwest, because that's where I live. Obviously, traveling it can be expensive if you take a plane. I try to drive to these different places, but there's tournaments everywhere: Mexico, Japan, China, Canada. And if you're competitive, you'll be there, and you'll find a way to get there. There's a lot of tournaments. The most recent arcade tournament was the King of the Kong Off, it's called, and it had the 10 world's 10 best world record holders of Donkey Kong, the arcade. And that was held in New Jersey. So that one I could not attend, but I knew a lot of the people that entered that tournament. But that was a big draw of people from all over. Maybe, I think a guy flew from England to be in that competition. And, you know, that's a little arcade in New Jersey is bringing people from England. I think that's cool. I think that's amazing. And so, yeah, it could be all over. The lifespan, I mean, once a tournament's over, you're on to the next one. There's not really a... I mean, there's tournaments that go on for a couple days where you start with qualifying, you get to the playoffs, and then or the finals, semifinals. But, you know, then they have yearly... I think there's yearly team tournaments for, like, the online shooting games where you have to qualify, then you travel to another city to get to the next qualifying round, and those can go on for months, maybe 2-3 months.
The different types of competitions and conventions that you host, do you want to say what the names of them are and about what time that they actually happen throughout the year?
Yeah. The one I personally run is called the Video Game Summit. We have a website I could give you. It's a kind of a long website. I can't give you the whole URL, but it's basically run in July every year. We do it for one day, probably from 8 in the morning to about 6 at night. And, you know, it's all ages. I think ages 9 or 12 or under are free. And then the entry fee for adults or older than 12 is about $10 or $15. I think we did $15 last event. So it's not a huge entry fee, but it's a lot of fun. Some of the other big ones, though, are in Wisconsin. Brookfield, Wisconsin is the Midwest Gaming Classic. That one's probably the biggest in the Midwest, and that runs from Thursday to Sunday. And that's pinball, arcades, and consoles, and tournaments, and vendors. And they bring in about, I know the guy who runs it, Dan, he probably brings in about 4,000 to 5,000 people for that weekend. People stay overnight. They come from all over the United States. It's one of the biggest ones. And then there's a lot of different arcades, like Doc owns Galloping Ghosts. He does tournaments probably once a month. You can set world records at his arcade. There's a gentleman, Pat, I think I mentioned to your teacher, at Star Worlds in DeKalb. He's got a small arcade there where he runs tournaments probably every weekend. I think he runs a tournament. And so, yeah, if you look hard enough online, there's a lot of places you can enter tournaments. But the one I personally run and the one I've been, from start to finish, is the Video Game Summit in Lumberg.
I've read somewhere that when there are competitors, sometimes they bring their own equipment. They don't want to use the equipment that's provided.
Right.
What does that look like? I mean,
well, it's funny. I went to one recently it was by the airport, kind of midway airport area, and it was a fighting game tournament. And everyone had their own joystick. And they have, it's almost like musicians walking with their guitar or their like trumpet or something. They had their joystick in their hand. And everyone had their own design, they had their sponsors on the joysticks. And it was cool. And I think that's neat because that kind of, it doesn't label them, but it symbolizes who they are based on their joystick. And when they sit down, you know, they could kind of know how the joystick plays, and yeah, it's pretty neat. There's certain games like the Xbox systems have certain specialty designed controllers, and I've seen people who have the controllers designed just for them. And I'm not a big fan of personalizing that stuff, but if you can do it, I say go for it, because it sets who you are.
Are there any restrictions on bringing your own equipment to the competition?
No. I think it's fair game. I think the only rules basically for competition is, are set in the game, like the time limit, the lives on certain games that you can have, and kind of the players you can use are set within the game, not the joystick.
I know most people play video games for the love of video games and the appreciation, but does it ever get so competitive that cheating takes place, and if so, how does cheating take place? What does that look like?
Well, I could tell you firsthand that I know people in the industry that have done that, have cheated. You know, I won't mention obviously names, but they've gotten a lot of flack from it. There's an online community nowadays with Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, a lot of things where you can instantly contact these people. And I'm part of a lot of those communities where there's a lot of negativity. And I try to stay away from it. I read it, I listen to it, but I don't get involved. And yeah, there are people who cheat, and there are people who submit scores that aren't true, and there are people who, you know, submit video, you know, videotapes and edit the tapes to make it look like they scored higher. And I read about it and I listen, but I stay neutral, and I'm friends with a lot of those people, and I go to different events where they talk about those people negatively, you know, negatively, and I go to a different event with that person and they talk negative, but I don't spread it.
But when you're at an actual competition,
if I see it,
yeah.
Yeah, it's brought up. Yeah, it's frowned upon. I mean, we would kick them out and we would disqualify them. It's not something that it's like any sport. If you cheat, you're not allowed to play. You can't. It's not fun if you cheat. It's not what we're there for. We're there to have fun. But if you cheat, that you're not part of the group, in my opinion.
So you had brought up that you also bowl.
Yes.
Right, and there's an etiquette coming to bowling, right? I don't bowl a lot, but as someone who does go to bowl, not competitively, I know that there's an etiquette that when someone's next to me on the other lane, that I wait until they throw the ball.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So what does etiquette look like in gaming?
Well, you know, again, that all depends on the game, but a lot of the etiquette is, you know, positivity, you know, not name-calling, foul language. That's frowned upon. You know, there's times where there's competitions going on. There's lots of people next to you. It's really crowded. You know, you want to stay to your space. There's, you know, people pushing. There's shoving. There's standing in front of the monitor, the arcade, the pinball machine. And you just gotta. It's like bowling. It's just natural etiquette where you gotta, you know what's good for you and what's not. You know. You got to stay within your own game, and if someone happens to do something that you don't like, you have to just report it, not to argue back or push them and stuff like that.
You had mentioned like the individuals that come in with their own joystick and they've got sponsorship there.
Sorry.
What are the typical levels of sponsorship in gaming, and what types of sponsors are they?
Oh boy, I mean, I have a brother-in-law. He works in the headphone business. The headphones are really popular now, the cordless headphones for video gaming. And he works for a company called SteelSeries where he makes headphones. And a lot of these competitive gaming gamers have headphones where their shirts have the name SteelSeries on them. They have sponsors on the shirts. They have sponsors on the joysticks, on their gloves. Some people use gloves because it hurts your hands if you play for a long time. So they have personalized gloves with the sponsors on it. It's almost like NASCAR. Like, you see the cars with all the sponsors? Gamers have that on their shirts and on all their equipment.
What are the typical prizes and what levels receive prizes? We talked a little bit about this, but what about some of the competitions that you haven't been hosting? What are some of the typical prizes?
Well, like, you know, like I, my personal ones, I give out like trophies and, like we said, swags, items that they can have and keep forever. Typically, prize funds for competitive gaming can go almost up to like the biggest prize fund tournament gaming today is, I think, 500 grand for a team tournament for the shooting games. If you win that, your team, you can win up to 500 grand. I mean, it's big. I'm not quite at that level to be, you know, in that or to host something like that, but I've seen it and it's incredible. It's like I said, it's competitive. It's serious stuff. But I'm a big believer in like trophies. Like my son, you know, gets trophies and I like giving out trophies for games at my events.
So you had mentioned that you the competition that you won. you grew the participation. How do you market to people? How do you keep your same base of people that come every year and then increase that base of competitors?
Just by word of mouth, and now with social media, I mean, like, you can just post something on there and it can go to thousands of people. I use like different medias like Craigslist, or I use like Facebook or Twitter or something like that, and I spread the word. And I've known so many different people in the industry that I have a big base of people throughout, you know, that could spread the word as well. So it's just like a domino effect. You can just tell a few people who will tell a few people who will tell a few people.
One of the interests that I have, and we'll be discussing this in our class in the next few weeks, is gaming as a sport. Really being considered as a sport.
Yeah.
Physically, the intensity, the hand-eye movement, all of that kind of stuff. What do you think about esports being compared to like physical football or basketball or volleyball?
I'm going to go back to bowling on this, because there's a lot of people in the world that consider bowling not a sport. People think football, baseball, golf, basketball, you got to break a sweat, you got to do this, but I always grew up knowing that bowling is a sport. It takes a mental focus. It takes, there's competition. You got to beat the other person. And I believe in video gaming, it's the same way. Yeah, you might be breaking a sweat, or you might not be running or getting exercise, but it's with your mental hand-eye coordination and your focus, it's just as serious as golf, baseball, or the other sports, or bowling that I played. And I kind of frown upon people who don't think video gaming competitively is a sport. It you have to be really good and talented. You have to practice. You have to spend a lot of time on it to be good at it. Just like anything. There's a ton of sports on TV that you would never consider a sport, but it's using your body, your mind, your practice that you used and playing against someone. That, to me, that's a sport.
I also pictured you earlier in the conversation. You talked about being almost on top of the TV, so that being part of the sport.
Yeah. It's kind of, you hear it a lot, but you're in the game. When you're in a zone and you're competitive in a game, nothing around you like matters. You're in the game, and that's how most sports are. When you're golfing and there's 200-300 people around the green, you have to focus on the green, not the people. Same with gaming. You got to focus on what you're doing, not the people.
That's interesting that you brought that up, because when I think about golf, it's supposed to be quiet, right?
Yeah.
But gaming, it always seems like it's loud. The fans behind you and the people watching the game are kind of in the game. They'll go, you miss, or like, yes, keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's the same in gaming. If you go to a competitive gaming convention, there's huge crowds. There's huge people cheering and getting involved with the person up there on the stage competing against someone. It's amazing. It's fun to watch. And I like meeting the people. I like seeing the different cultures. That's another thing about gaming that I've met. I've met people from all over the world. And it's not many places. I live in North Suburbs of Chicago. You don't meet a lot of people with your everyday life. But when you go to these conventions, there's so many different cultures and people I meet. It's awesome to hear the history of the different.
We know you play the games.
Yeah.
We know you throw conventions on. But how are you what is the experience that you feel when you're watching someone else play the game?
I'm more of a, and I don't think I've mentioned this either, I enjoy more watching.
Spectating,
because I get a thrill watching someone win, or someone like trying their best and getting a score and beating it. I love watching that. I could watch that all day. I could sit all day long and watch someone try to like compete with someone online or on a game. And that's why I love doing the video game summit, because I love setting up all my systems and all my games and hosting tournaments so I can watch them enjoy it. That's why I did my birthday party. It wasn't really about me. It was about the people coming and enjoying the old games and competing against each other and being excited that they won. And that's a thrill for me. I enjoy that more than being in the tournament. I think sometimes in the tournament there's so much stress and tension and seriousness that you lose the fun of it, you lose the feel.
I saw on ESPN when I was flipping through the stations, and I found it very interesting to see esports taking this turn. It was the Varsity Challenge with college students.
Mm.
What do you know anything about that, about actual esports in colleges and where that might go?
You know, I don't know much about that part of it, but I do know that, you know, we talked about Walter Day, who founded Twin Galaxies. Twin Galaxies and Walter Day are going to that esports segue. They're moving to that. That's like the new generation of gaming is the esports. So that's it. It's definitely going to be the new norm of video gaming. And I've heard that term so many times lately, is esports, that, you know, it's something that I'm learning more and more every day about it. And, you know.
Well, the first team that won, the team that placed number one, had $30,000, I think, a piece in scholarship, which I thought was interesting, because when you go back and compare it to the physical sports that everybody agrees in the norm, that these are physical sports, these are real sports, but not so sure about esports being real sports. When you sign on to a college team to be a basketball player, you play that whole semester, that
right.
whole year for your
right.
scholarship. And here, it's you win this tournament, and you win $30,000
right.
for your scholarship.
Right.
What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I guess I'm used to that. Like, when I bowled, you know, most of the tournaments that I bowled in were for scholarship money. So it was like one tournament, and you win scholarship money. I don't know. I think, in my opinion, college students who can get scholarships in any way is a positive thing. I'm not opposed to if it's one day or if it's a whole year or if it's them working for it or if they, you know, if they compete and they get it. With college college tuition nowadays, if they can get as much scholarship as they can, I'm all for it.
What was one of the main challenges that you came across while planning a convention or a competition?
Oh, very recent, the last one I did in July. The hardest part, well, when you plan a convention, you got to reserve the space. That's the hardest part, is to find enough space. And when you get the space, then it's how do you fit everyone in there? How do you get it to where it's comfortable? And I just faced a challenge last July where we had so many people and so many vendors that we filled it up to where it was very difficult. At last minute, we had to make some changes to make everyone fit. We're talking now about finding a bigger place next year. So my biggest challenge for stuff like that is getting enough setup so it's comfortable for everybody. Finding the room is easy, but to set up the tables, the monitors, the arcades, just the electrical stuff, getting that where people don't trip over the cords and where people don't, you know, unplug something while you're in the middle of the game and then the plug comes out. That's the worst. And I know so many stories where people have played games. There's the newest thing now is a marathon gaming, where you play one game for as long as you can without turning it off. And I know people playing 50, 60, even up to 80 hours without stopping. And to hear stories where they're up to like 30, 40 hours and then the plug comes out, or that's just hard. So that's a huge, like, you don't, that's like the biggest, you know, no-no, is if you don't have everything set up right and it turns off.
Are they allowed to pause the game to take a drink
or
something?
No, you can't pause. There's certain games where you can get a lot of lives, where you have so many lives where you can actually maybe go to the washroom or get a drink, and you can die a few times. But you can't pause. That takes away the marathon. There's no pausing. And a lot of these are arcade games, and you can't pause in arcade games. There's no pause button. So you got to let it go. I was just at a guy's house August in Iowa, where he's the first person to get 1 billion points on an arcade. And he's still got the original game in his house. And he played I think I watched a lot of it. I tried to stay up and stay up with him and be supportive. But he played for, I think, 42 hours straight. And he did it online, on streaming online. You could watch him. So I'd sleep for a few hours, and yeah, he's still playing and sleeping. And so it's kind of cool. He's got a documentary out coming out end of this month, which I'm looking forward to, because he's a competitive gamer.
Gaming has a community, and it also has a culture. And depending on where you are in the world, it probably has a different type of culture. What does the Chicago culture look like compared to the rest of the country, whether it be competitions or just gaming?
Yeah, it's big. I wouldn't say it's the biggest, but it's big. A lot of, I think the biggest area probably in the States is the Wisconsin-Chicago area, probably the north, like with the Kenosha, Racine, Brookfield area, and then in the like north suburbs with the Chicagoland area. But it's getting bigger. Like there's arcades now opening, like I said, in Brookfield. There's a restaurant in Chambray in the Woodfield Mall that just opened up, and it's designed around Pac-Man. And I think your teacher is actually interviewing the owner, who's the vice president of Namco, and he opened up a restaurant where there's bowling in there, there's arcades, there are tables where when you sit down to eat, have the games built in the table where you could play. So it's getting even bigger. And so I would think probably the number one place to go to conventions and tournaments are like kind of in the California area. I haven't been to any of those. It's just, the traveling is hard, but I see a lot online of the big competitions in like California. But Chicago's right behind it. If you want to enter a tournament or be in some sort of competitive gaming, there's, you got McCormick Place, you got O'Hare, there's a huge, the banquet halls in O'Hare Airport are big, and then you got, the suburbs where we reserve like different hotels and banquet halls. So I think we're in like the top three or four in the United States for areas for competitive gaming.
What do you see as the future for the gaming industry overall in comparison to the future of the gaming industry in Chicago?
I think Chicago is going to keep up. I think because of the population that it grows every day in Chicago, I think that the more people that live here, the more events you're going to see, the more gaming you're going to see. I see worldwide, I think gaming is just going to be even bigger. I think, already it's bigger than music, it's bigger than movies, it makes more money than probably both of those combined. I think with the technology and the kids growing up nowadays with iPhones and all that, I think them going to school and knowing this technology and designing these games, it's just going to be insane. I'm curious how my son's, is my age, what gaming's going to be like. I can't even fathom. I think as everything's going to be, it's going to be virtual. I think people are going to start going into virtual worlds, which in my opinion is scary, if you want to ask me the truth. But it's not going to be TVs anymore, I think, in the next 10 years. I think everything's going to be virtual. I think you're going to have the game in front of you. I think you're going to, go into this new world. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I'm kind of proud that I've been part of the start of it all. And that's why my collection is so important to me, because I can keep the memories of the old days and the new days together and be able to talk about it and share it with my kids.
This question I like too. How do you see yourself fitting into the future gaming industry?
Oh, I think I'd be doing a lot more, actually. I think I would love to do more, and if I work hard at it, I will. I want to be more involved in, like I said, I want to do two or three more conventions rather than once a year. I want to host and be a part of as many as I can in the time, in a year. I want to travel more. I want to go to more places like California or different parts of the country, even out of the United States, and spread my knowledge and my collections and my talent to other people. I do see myself doing that. I think when my kids get older and they're more sufficient on their own and they're in their teens and I can travel more, I will be doing that because it's a part of my life and I don't want it to really fade away.
You mentioned that you go to different arcades. Mm-hmm. How often do you go to those arcades?
I try to go. I don't go as much as I used to. But if I go to any restaurant or any place that has an arcade game, I will play it. I can't stay away from it. I go to probably the Galloping Ghost Arcade maybe once, probably every other month or so. I go up there just to see what's going on or play a game and stuff. I bring my son there. When my son went to Northern in DeKalb, that arcade, Star Worlds, was right there. I was going there like twice a month, three times a month. And then we used to hold a lot of conventions at his arcade. A couple of years ago, I was going quite a bit. It's tampered off a little recently, but you know, I'd like to change that. I'd like to go to more.
Do you have a favorite arcade?
It's hard to say nowadays. There's not that many. Like, those are the two main ones that are, you know, in this area. You know, I'd have to say that. You know, I know both people at both arcades that I've been to, and I think they're both different in both ways. Like, the Doc's arcade, he's set a world record for most games in a single arcade. He's got, like, over 400, I think, arcade games. And, you know, that's, if you're into that, that's huge. Now, Pat's, you know, arcade in DeKalb is a lot smaller, but it's a more of a community, and you can be with people, you know, because it's not so huge and everyone's just spread out. You can be together and it's more of a community, so I like that part of it too. So I don't have a favorite, but those are the two that that I go to most. There's the arcade in New Jersey just closed recently. The owner closed it, and that was the one I would have wanted to go to before he closed it, and that would have been my favorite, but he closed it. But that's where the Pong Offs were. That's where all the different games from, he redesigned all the games from like the 70s to today in arcades. He's just amazing. He can take a cabinet from scratch and repaint it, redecal it, fix it up, and make it look brand new from the 70s. And I wish I could have made it to there before he closed it. But
if you were to become an owner of an arcade, what would that arcade look like and what would be the experience?
That would be awesome. In fact, if I had a dream, if it could come true, that would be a dream of mine. I would like to open up like a restaurant arcade, which he's done actually in Schaumburg. It's more of a Pac-Man themed, but I'd like to do more of everything from the history, and it would involve, you know, just having like a restaurant and like a bar, but showing the history of gaming. So having the games from the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, 2000s to today, and seeing, you know, sharing the history of people. Plus, I'd love to open up, my goal, and I don't know when it will be, and hopefully soon, is to open up a museum to display and have all this stuff that I've been collecting and be able to show people and have people talk about it and do stuff like that, where it's open every day, where people can come in and see this. That would be my ultimate goal, is to have like a museum. They tried to do it in Iowa back in 2010, and it just didn't didn't go over well. I wasn't able to help out with it. I live here, and the people trying to run it there, it didn't work. So I've talked to them, and I've gotten ideas, and I've gotten advice, and that would be my goal. I would hope that the next 5 years is open up a museum where I can display all this, and then have people donate stuff to the museum as well, you know.
Is there a museum for gaming that you've gone to that were really...
There's one in St. Louis. There's an archive. I think there's a museum archive. I haven't been to it, but I've read about it, and I've talked to people who have been there, but it's very small. It's more of a... It's not really design. It's more of a technology museum, not really video gaming. So they have phones, and they have TVs, old TVs, and they have old stuff with technology, and the video game section is kind of small. I'd love to just focus the whole museum on video gaming. and arcades, and pinball, and stuff like that. So, you know, I've never been to one that, I don't even think there is one just solely on video games, at least not that I know of. They have different, like, conventions and stuff where once a year they all display their old stuff, but then they take it down and bring it home. I want something that would, you know, stay there and have people any day they wanted to come in and see it. So.
You had mentioned that there was an arcade that closed, mm-hmm. and the gentleman yeah. who owned that arcade was able to redesign and
yeah.
remachine those cabinets. Are you able to do any of that at arcade games?
No. I wish I could. What I can do is the console stuff. I can fix and take apart the old consoles, the games, and make them work again. And that's my passion, is the more the console area, where I can find an old system that's been in someone's basement for 20 years and it doesn't work, and I can fix it and make it work. I've gotten old games that are kind of broken, bent, and I've repaired them and fixed them. Arcade's a whole different ball game. I would love to. In fact, I tried once. I bought an old cabinet. I put it in my garage here, and all I needed to buy was the board and get the decals and stuff, and I'm like, this is a lot of work. I don't know if I can do it. And so I just stuck with the consoles and everything else. And plus, for me, I don't have the space for arcades. This gentleman who had an arcade had 40 to 50 games in his house. He had enough space, and then he opened up next door his arcade, which is attached to the house. So it was convenient for him. I just don't have the space. And I'd love to, but I just didn't have that time.
We talked earlier, in the very beginning of the conversation, about the evolution of consoles.
Yeah.
Were there any milestones of those games in the evolution that stand out to you?
The one that stands out for me is the Sega Dreamcast. That came out in 99. It was, it kind of went from, you know, it went from the cartridge games mm-hmm. to like CD-ROM games. And the Dreamcast, it was way ahead of its time, because now CD-ROM games are, it's nothing. That's what they do. But in 99, that was really high-end stuff, and the gaming just took it just jumped to a new level. The graphics, the sound, the gameplay. And I remember getting it. That was another system I stood in line for and got it opening day. It came out 9/9 of 99, September 9th of 99. It was just the coolest date to come out. The marketing was genius with the date. And that's the one that stands out for me, that kind of turned around the technology. And in fact, that one of my books I have over there too is the Rise and Fall of Sega, and one of the rises was the Dreamcast, and then right after that is when Sega fell and sold to Nintendo, and the rest is history. But the Dreamcast was one of the pioneers, I think. In the 80s was Nintendo, obviously, was the Nintendo Entertainment System, but in the late 90s was the Dreamcast. That's the one that sticks out for me.
I know you play games, you've done competitions.
Yep.
You've been to different arcades,
mm-hmm.
But you also research games and game history. I saw that
a
in
lot.
Some of your collection. Yeah.
A lot.
So
yep.
Were there sometimes that the gaming industry had technology that they didn't release right away? They might have held onto it for 4 or 5 years before they released that technology. And why would they do that?
You know, they didn't really. It's funny. There's not really something that they held onto for a long time. What they did is they came out with kind of things that failed. Like, for instance, the Virtual Boy that I have in the garage was the first 3D video game system. It came out probably early 90s, maybe, 93, 94. And it was one of those, you put on the table, you have this big thing you put on your head, and it was 3D. It was like two colors. It was red and black. And it just failed. It just did not. No one was ready for 3D. So they had that technology. They kind of put it off to the side. And now you have, you know, the Game Boy in 3D without glasses. You can watch that Nintendo Game Boy 3DS without glasses, and the screen pops out at you. It's pretty sweet. I'll have to show you when we're done. So they had that technology for so long, they just were, the world wasn't ready for it, and it was too expensive to do. Another thing that, you know, obviously stood out was the CD-ROMs. They had that technology probably in the 80s, but it just was too expensive, and it was stuff that, you know, they didn't even have CDs for music in the 80s. It was all, you know, VHS or tape cassette. And they didn't have DVD-ROMs. They had VHS, and they didn't have Blu-ray, and just the world wasn't ready, so that they held that for a long time. Other things, I mean, I think the joysticks, like the Wii with the wireless wand, that technology was here probably 15 years ago. It's just, it didn't work. They were testing and beta testing and beta testing, and then finally when the Wii came out, you know, when that came out. But yeah, there's a lot to, there's still today, there's technology that is being built that they could probably come out with, but it won't be ready for like 10 years. I know there's like, you know, the touchscreen games where, you know, they have the iPhone games where you can touch with the phone, but I mean, there's gonna be gaming on TVs where you can just put your finger in the air and play the whole game, and it's gonna be awesome.
Many games have been re-released. In your opinion, were the re-releases as successful as the original release, and why?
No, in my opinion, they weren't. And it depends on what kind of re-releases you're talking about. Like The Legend of Zelda, for instance, my favorite game, they re-released it on the Game Boy, or you can even download the digital version on the Wii. It's just not the same as having the original joystick and cartridge, in my opinion. There's games like in the garage right now, I have Pac-Man, they remastered for the PlayStation. But that's not the same as an arcade. You can't play Pac-Man on your TV. You have to stand in front of an arcade and play Pac-Man. And there's hundreds of examples I would have, but in my opinion, it's not better. And that's why I'm fascinated by the consoles and the old games. Like there's things called MAME nowadays and ROMs. You can probably act like almost 3,000 games. You could probably download all those games on a ROM and play them on your, you know, iPad. But to me, that's not the same. It's not the same game experience. So, I'm not for remastering games.
Many games have been offered as a series, like Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, etc. What do you feel about a series? Do you like the original games more, or the ones that came after in a series, or did the series enhance your love for gaming?
I think the series is a good thing. I think it enhanced my love for gaming. I think, you know, playing one Final Fantasy, I think now they're on 20 or 19 or 20 now. I think that enhances the gameplay because the storyline continues. The one negative thing they do sometimes is they take like Pac-Man and then they make like Turbo Pac-Man or like Pac-Man Land, and it's like, well, that's not the same. That's kind of pushing the envelope a little. Or like, you know, Super Mario is probably the one that has changed the most. I think there's 30-something Mario games out there. One just came out last week, which I got, the Mario Maker, where you can design your own Mario games. It's pretty cool. But besides Mario, I think, you know, I think changing games up and adding to the storyline is a good thing. You know, like, there's games out there, the Uncharted games, there's 3 of them. 4 is coming out in February. I think it's going to be a hot seller. I think it's a good thing because you keep the story going, the character grows up and goes through different adventures. Sometimes, like, you get, like, the Madden footballs and you come out with one every year. I'm a little against that. I think it's just kind of a moneymaker thing. It's the same game, just new players. I don't know. So it depends on the game.
When you start a new game, could be back when you first started playing games or playing a new game now, does it take a lot for you to learn that game? Do you read up on it before you play it? Do you, I don't know if they come with instructions, or do you just figure it out as you go along?
You know what's weird is they don't come with instructions anymore because everything's paperless, like the Go Green world. So everything's like online now. So there aren't really manuals anymore. You just kind of have to plug it in. I never had to do that. I just kind of picked up on them right away. Gaming nowadays, when you put in a game, it kind of walks you through how to play. So if you're new at it, you get to know. If you're really good at it, you don't need it, you can skip it. In the old days, back in when I was a kid, I was just naturally good at it. I didn't have to read up on it. I would just be really good. I would just play and just be really good at it. I think that I've kind of gone backwards. I kind of now read the books about the games I played when I was a kid to see how I can get better, but not I didn't do it when I was a kid. So I think it's fun to go back and read about the games that I used to play and see what I missed and what I didn't know about.
Can you think of anything that you might have missed?
I mean, it depends on the game. Every game's different. There's a lot, Pac-Man, I bring it up, so I'll talk about it, but there's so many patterns in Pac-Man. You'd think you just go around. But to get, like, a perfect Pac-Man score, which there's only a handful of people in the world that have done it, there's a pattern that the ghosts go in every level. And there's 200, which is the restaurant, 257 levels. And every level has a pattern. So when I grew up, I was good at it, but didn't realize there was a new level of people who could get to like level 257 and beat the game. And so now that I read up on it, I'm trying to get better at it.
What happens at 257 when they actually reach that?
Level 257, it happens, there's a split screen and you get Pac-Man on this side and then there's just gibberish on the right side. Like the code just went berserk and you play and then the game freezes and it's called the kill screen. And then you die. The memory of the game doesn't know what to do because you got so far. It just your man dies and your game's over. You get to the end.
You have more than 2,800 games. Is that what you said?
I have
over 2,000.
I have 2,840.
40.
And I have them inventoried. That's the only reason I know. Yeah.
Why is it so important? Do you have this collection?
Well, it all started. When I got the new systems, I just had good memories of the old systems, and I still had a few games, and I wanted to put them in and play them, and I'm like, wow, I used to have that game. And then back in the day, you used to be able to trade games to like video game stores and get credit. And then I traded so many games. And now with eBay and thrift stores and Craigslist, I found a way you can get those games back. So I got a handful like games that I used to play, and I started playing, and I'm like, this is fun. I want to play more. And then it just got to be, I wouldn't say an obsession, but just like kind of a passion to get as many of the old games as I can. And I mean, here we are. I've always collected things like baseball cards or coins when I was a kid, or I collected Garbage Pail Kids, remember those? And I was just always a collector, but not to this magnitude. And I found something that I actually enjoyed collecting and playing, so I just kept it going. My goal, I've always set a goal, like every 6 months I would say on my forums, I would say I'm going to have this amount of games by this time. And then I made it a challenge for myself. So it almost became a game for me, is like to see if I can get to this point. And I think, like we said before our interview, I don't really go online and pay for everything. Like, you know, you can go on eBay and buy the complete set of Atari games for $5,000. I don't do that. I get enjoyment out of trading, finding deals, going to conventions and getting these games at low prices. You know, the newer games are 60, 70 bucks, which is crazy. I try not to spend on the retro games more than $5. If it's more than $5, I'll find it somewhere else. So when you look at my collection, you may think, you know, I've spent tens, 20, $30,000. I haven't. It's more of just finding a way to get the games that I want at a reasonable price or a trade. And for me, that's the best way to collect. I don't like to just go out and say, well, I have 5,000 games, and last week I bought 4,000 of them. So that's what I take passion in my collection, is that I actually worked for it. I just didn't go online and get them all. And I don't know, it's almost a hobby. Like, I love bowling. That's my passion, my hobby since I was 8 years old. But I can't do it every day. But I can do this every day if I wanted to. I can play a game, or I could go to a arcade, or I can go to a store and get a game. So that's why I've kept it up.
Have you played every game in your collection? And how frequently do you play?
I get that question a lot from my friends and people who know my collection. The only thing I can say to that is I haven't necessarily played them all, but I've actually made sure they've worked. So if I get a game from a store, or if I've actually got something from a convention, I'll plug them in, I'll turn them on, maybe play for a few minutes. If they work, then I'll put them back. If they're broken, I'll either try to fix it or I'll get a working one. So at one point, every one of those games has been plugged in and played. Not from start to finish, but yes, verified that they work.
So across the different consoles that you have, do you have a game that plays each one of those consoles, or at least plays one or two different consoles, but it's the same game?
So your question is, like, do I have Pac-Man on, like, four different consoles?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have lots of versions like that. I have, like, Donkey... Like, a lot of the, like I said, a lot of the old games got remanufactured to play on different systems. So, like, the Pac-Man in my garage is on the PlayStation 2. Donkey Kong is on the Nintendo. I have Donkey Kong for an Atari 2600. I have Donkey Kong for Intellivision. I have, you know, Donkey Kong for the Xbox. So I have many games that try to recreate the original, but they're not the original. But for me, my collection is more of just as many games as I can. Like I said before our interview again, I don't have any doubles. My collection is all individual games. So I have an inventory and a spreadsheet of every game I own. So if I go to a convention or I look at my spreadsheet, and if I already own it, I don't take it. So my 2,840 games are all single games. Some people have 500, 600, 700 games, but they have doubles of every game in my collection. Everything's different. Every game you look at is individual.
And is Nintendo your best console? Is your favorite console? Or
The Nintendo Entertainment's... that's a tough one. I go back and forth because the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Sega Dreamcast are my two favorites. I think my most memories and my favorite games are on the Nintendo Entertainment System. So if I had to choose, I'd choose that one. I think the biggest... I think Sega, if the Dreamcast did better and lasted longer, it would be my favorite, but it didn't last too long. Like, Nintendo still to this day is popular with the world. So I'd have to go with Nintendo. I used to be... back when I was really into video gaming in the 80s and 90s, I was a Sega fan. It was like Team Sega or Team Nintendo back in the day. There wasn't Xbox or PlayStation, and I was always Sega. I was against Nintendo. I didn't get the Super Nintendo or the, you know, GameCube, any of that. And then, I think what changed for that? I think the Dreamcast, after the Dreamcast, there was a few systems after that that failed. And then I went on Nintendo's Team Nintendo. But now you can play Sonic. Sonic is on a Nintendo game. I think Nintendo bought Sega, so you can play Sonic on Nintendo. There's Sega characters in Nintendo games. It's all merged now. There's no...
Did your friends tease you when you went to Nintendo then?
Yeah, when I was on Nintendo and not Sega? Yeah. They say I was like kind of like... I was a traitor. I moved from Nintendo to Sega, but you know it was for the best. I mean, Sega was kind of going downhill, and Nintendo was the way to go. And nowadays, it doesn't matter. I enjoy anything that people make. You know, I think now the big guys are Nintendo, Microsoft, and Sony. I'll play them all. You know, I like them all.
When gamers are serious about playing, they all spend exorbitant amounts of money to have the best equipment, even though the game can be played without this equipment. Are you one of those gamers, and if yes, what drives you to purchase the additional equipment?
Well, you know what a good example is the newest fad right now is these portals, like Skylanders, or the newest thing now is these Amiibos for Nintendo, where if you get the game, you need the characters to play the game. I have some of those examples over there on my table, but I'm not a fan of that marketing scheme. I'm a fan of collecting the characters, and I think they're cool. But the way that they kind of are marketing kids, where you have to buy like 70 of these characters to play the game, which you don't, but they market it on commercials that, you know, you need this character to be in this and this and this and this. I get it because they want to make money, but I'm not a true believer that that's the way to sell video games. You know, the Wii's different. Like, you could play driving games. They have a Wii wheel that you can drive with. You know, I get that for some games. I don't need it, but I think it adds to the realism. I think headphones, like I was speaking with earlier, are very important because with the sound and music nowadays of games, I think you get the true experience on a headphone. And I think if you're going to buy a PlayStation 4 nowadays and you want the true experience, that you should get a headphone. It's not necessary. It's not. It doesn't make the game better, but it adds to the realism of it.
We're getting to the end of the interview, and it's been fascinating.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
And I so want to make sure that I didn't miss out on something that was important that you wanted to share with us. So I have two questions for you.
Okay.
How have games influenced your life, and in what way, and how, and the way you live it? How have games influenced your life and the way you live it?
Mm-hmm.
And what are some other things that you would like to share with us in this interview that may not have been covered in our questions?
Well, I think video games, like... I always put video games and bowling in my life together, because without bowling and video games, I may have gone a different path in my life. I think the friends I made in bowling and in video gaming, you know, are unmatched. I don't think I could find better people in the world today that I've met through my two hobbies that I've had. I think video games changed the way I hang out with my children. I think it's a safe and fun environment to be with your children and have fun times and laugh and have stories and share my memories with them. I think the growing up, you know, being the age I am and the generation where video gaming began, I think growing up with the technology is fascinating and has changed my life. Seeing how things have gone from, you know, big 80-pound tube TVs to 2-pound flat panel TVs, I'm kind of honored that I'm a part of this growth in the world, and I'm glad to share that with my son and show him the old days and how that works. You know, in terms of what haven't I covered, I mean, I think we've dealt with a lot of topics. I think I'm proud to be a part of the community that I am with video gaming. I don't think it's going to get any, you know, there's going to be no end to it, I don't think. And I'm hoping one day that, you know, I could be remembered when I'm old and my grandchildren or great-grandchildren talk about me, that they think that they had a pretty cool dad, grandpa that got into this stuff. You know, my neighbors and friends who come over think it's kind of cool that Aiden's dad and Hannah's dad have 3,000 video games in their garage, and they're pretty, you know, it's something for my kids to talk about with their friends. So I'm glad that it's part of my life, and I'm glad I got to share with you, and I'm hoping that, you know, one day, 10 years from now, there'll be more to talk about, and this will be a good archive of what's to come in the future.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
I really appreciate you too.
Thank you
so
much
for coming here and doing this.
And opening your house to us and showing us the games that you have.
Oh, no problem. I'm honored.
Well, one last thing I have to include in the audio recorder is that today Judy Houlihan and me, Xi Rao, is doing an interview with Todd Friedman. Todd Friedman. Today is September 25th, 2015, and it happens in Mr. Freeman's home. Thank you.
That wasn't too bad, was it?
No, that was great.
Did you get all that in one little?
I think, yeah.
That was